You know, it's funny that a person whose work is so familiar to us should not have the name recognition as others who have touched our lives. This is especially true in the arts. You know, think of music, think of the music business with its thousands of singers, instrumentalists, recording engineers, producers, songwriters, and more. Only a very small fraction are household names. This brings me to my special guest today. The man who sits across from me in the studio has had more top 10 hit records than any other arranger in the history of pop music. He has worked with artists ranging from Frankie Valli of the Four Seasons to Bruce Springsteen, Barry Manilow, Barbra Streisand, and Sinatra, to name just a few. And if you think it's only the music of baby boomers in our generation, he's also mentored Ariana Grande and helped point the way to her first recording session at age 12. So I'd like to introduce Charlie Colello. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here.
You know, it's funny because we met briefly a few years ago at the concert of my cousin, David Pomerantz, at the Black Box in Boca Raton. And I had no idea that you had produced and arranged that album. And I know he's my cousin and all of that, and I have had him on the show, but that was a wonderful album, and he's quite the artist.
He was a brilliant songwriter, and he wrote one of my favorite songs that Barry recorded.
Barry Manilow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. So, you know, he had his touch with stardom, but as a solo artist, you know, the light did not shine on him in particular, right?
Lightning did not, was not caught in the bottle.
So where were you from originally?
Originally from Newark, New Jersey, and I grew up in an area called Down Neck.
Down Neck.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Like Great Neck, Down Neck, Up Neck. I don't know.
It was surrounded by railroad tracks, and it was also referred to as the Ironbound section.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And it was Newark, right? So that was, it was a condition of Newark back then.
Broken up into basically neighborhoods, ethnic neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And I lived in a Polish-German neighborhood, not really an Italian neighborhood. The Italian neighborhood was a little different section of where I lived.
So you were a Jersey boy, and that's going to play later in your story for sure. But when you were growing up, your father was a musician, right?
Yeah, he was a club date musician. He was probably one of the most in-demand trumpet players that did weddings, bar mitzvahs. And one of the reasons why he was used, he had a great sound. He knew all the tunes, and he could sight read.
Yeah. Boy, those are three killer characteristics for a musician, right?
Yeah.
He was also a jazz lover, right?
In his record collection, he was the one that had the Miles Davis recordings. And as a kid, when I first listened to the record and I heard the record move, the first thing I looked at was who was playing on the record, who wrote the arrangement.
Yeah.
It must have been, must have been like four when I did that. I don't really remember.
Well, that was the thing. You know, early on, people started to realize that you had a way of putting chords together in songs and rearranging the chords in songs and starting to this idea of kind of arranging. And so how did that develop?
I was a very poor student. I started as an accordion player and hated the accordion. Didn't want to practice it. And as a result of it, instead of practicing my scales and my arpeggios, I'd hear songs on the radio and I'd want to play them. So I sort of learned how to play music and used my ear. And although I was learning to read music, primarily everything I did by ear because I would listen to things and I'd say, oh, I like the way this sounds. I like the way that sounds.
So you take the record and you'd put it on and you get a couple of notes and then you put the needle back and over and over and over again.
Well, later on I did that when I started to study arranging. I was mesmerized by the arrangements that were written for Sinatra.
Yeah, those beautiful Nelson Riddle.
So then I started to listen to them and I started to write the individual parts, the trumpet part, the alto part, the trombone part.
Which really served you well later on as well because you were actually writing for pretty big orchestras later in your career.
It was a wonderful education because by listening and actually studying those recordings, you learn orchestral techniques that they just don't teach you anyplace else. You just have to listen. Then eventually you find out what you like and you eventually start writing that.
Yeah, so it's kind of learning the business, training your ear from the ground up instead of necessarily going to school first and learning the theory. You listened and then you learned a lot from listening and then that was reinforced later when you went to school.
Well, primarily going to school and learning, going to a music school. I went to the first music and arts school in the country, which was an advantage. But when I studied music, I found out that a lot of the composers that we studied in school, and they tried to analyze, as you took a look at the way that they worked, it sort of like was no different than the way we worked. They sort of got an idea, they developed it, and they wrote it.
And then they wrote it.
And basically, when you start to think about that, there was really no difference between them and us.
Mm-hmm.
All we had to do was do the same thing. And they wrote works of art. Now, could we actually eventually have works of art?
Yeah, I get you. So the idea is they're sitting at the piano, kind of playing what they're hearing and figuring this part out, figuring that, and then putting it down on paper. Whereas we, hundreds of years later, we look at this and go, oh, this is on the paper. It's like paper is part of it.
Right.
But that's not actually how it started. That's
right,
interesting.
Right.
Well, you know, it's kind of especially amazing, and this is definitely a digression, but, you know, Beethoven wrote, he was deaf. You know, as a kid, I was like, how is that even possible that you can write these beautiful things and not even hear it? But of course, he heard it inside his head.
What was intimidating about studying those works is that when you looked at them, they were perfect. They were written perfectly. There were no mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
The articulations were all mentioned. The dynamics were mentioned. But then you think back over 200 or 300 years that these things were played. Eventually, the musicians kept on marking them up.
Mm-hmm.
So when I would play an arrangement, I'd say, you know, maybe I need to write all this stuff. You find out that the musicians really would do it.
Yeah.
And ultimately, when they found the style that it needed to be in, then you'd mark it up correctly.
Interesting. Interesting. So as I mentioned before, you were a Jersey boy and you kind of fell in with an interesting crowd that really kind of defined most of your career. So tell us about that.
Meeting Frankie Valli?
Yeah, just that little thing.
We had a band of music students from Arts High School and they were all really good players, good musicians. And we started to sing. So we were singing in four-part harmony, like the Four Freshmen and the High Lows.
Mm-hmm.
And Frankie was working with a group called the Four Lovers. They were sort of like a country, Italian R&B group.
Is that possible? I don't even...
It was a mixture. They played all those kinds of music.
Yeah.
And they did it with two guitars, a bass, and a cocktail drum. So Frankie was quite famous in the city because he had a hit record in 1956 on RCA called You're the Apple of My Eye.
Mm-hmm.
So here it was around 1958, and I was working in a club in New Jersey. He walked into the club, and he heard our band and heard us singing, and he was, you know, impressed by what we did, and he asked who wrote the arrangements, so they pointed to me.
I see. Well, you were pretty young, though, right?
I was 20.
You were 20. But even before that, you were going to Atlantic City playing, I don't know if you were playing bass at that time or accordion.
I played accordion in a gin mill on Kentucky Avenue in Atlantic City called Eddie Shamrock.
Yeah, and you were what, 16 or something?
15 going on 16.
Yeah, and how did your parents even ever let you go? You were on your own too, right?
Yeah, well, my mother didn't want me to go. My father, who was a musician, said, let him go. It would be good for him.
Yeah.
And it was really a great experience.
Well, you know, there's this idea that, you know, developing any kind of skill like this takes thousands of hours of playing, let's say in this case. You know, the Beatles were in Germany before they became famous and they were playing six nights a week, you know, two shows a night. So they had their 10,000 hours, as they say. So you really started early. I mean, you got a lot of those hours in pretty early.
Well, in Atlantic City, right up the street, was where we used to go after work. We finished at 3 in the morning. And myself and a friend of mine, we were both about the same age. We found out that the entertainment went till 5 there. So we'd go up the street and we saw Al Hibbler, Ray Charles, and people like this that were working up the street.
Yeah.
And at that hour, you could walk in and nobody would bother you.
Yeah.
So we were exposed to a degree of performance at that level at the age of 15 that was not seen by many of the other people in our area.
The place and the times played a big role in this. Charlie Colello, one of the great arrangers, and a little bit of songwriting and a little bit of this and a little bit of that has contributed to pop music in America. And we were talking about his time with the Four Seasons. So Charlie, we started really early. You had met Frankie Valli and some of his crew. I want to mention some of these names. These are people who won't know about the Four Seasons. Who were they?
Frankie Valli, Tommy DeVito, Bob Gaudio, and Nick Massey. And anyone who's seen Jersey Boys knows that the four of them became, you know, the Four Seasons that were responsible for all those early hits.
They weren't just musicians and singers. They were songwriters too, right?
Gaudio was the primary songwriter. Frankie, primarily the singer.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy, you'd have to see the play to see Tommy's part. Nicky was really an amazing vocal arranger. He had an instinctive way of putting vocal parts together. So harmoniously, the group worked. And when I got involved with Frankie 4 years before the Four Seasons. So we started to build this camaraderie before that period of time. And then after Sherry Baby, when things started to become really hectic, when they had to produce on a large scale, they called me back to help them make the records because, A, neither one of them could read or write music. They knew that I had that ability.
Yeah.
They also knew that I was able to do things that they weren't able to do when it came time to even coming up with ideas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I got started with them, and out of the first 26 chart records that we had, I was involved with 22 of them, I believe.
Chart record means you're getting, the 50 top?
Chart records, anything that reached like the top 20 within top 20. Billboard.
Okay.
And most of those records. I did 22 of the 24 or 26 records that they had.
Now, back then, it was all four-track. It was just a very simple recording. And one of the key notes to the sound of the Four Seasons was them doubling their voices. So that took some doing, I would think. You've got four singers and you're doubling their voices. And so you're kind of eating up the tracks. And that was before the Beatles and before a lot of the A-tracks and the bigger mixing systems came in. And today it's unlimited because it's all digital,
right?
But back then, it was a physical impossibility almost to kind of do this kind of thing. Four Seasons was involved in that pretty early.
1959, I started to make records with Frankie and the guys that were in the Four Seasons and Bob Crewe. So 3 years before the Four Seasons hit, Bob Crewe bought a four-track tape machine, and he introduced me to making records with very few musicians by doubling or using musicians to play multiple parts.
Mm-hmm.
So the first record I made with him was a song called An Angel Cried, which had strings, it had horns and everything. We did it with the band I was working with and three violin players that he hired.
And it sounded like a full orchestra, pretty much, right?
Pretty much so. And then what Bob developed, he developed the art of making the track. He would make the track on all four tracks, mix it down to a mono.
Mm-hmm.
And I explain all of this in my book,
right,
that he would take the mono track, then re-record it back onto the four track. Then we would do the background parts with the Four Seasons. Then we double the background parts, and then we put Frankie's voice on. Now, when we doubled the background parts, we used the technique called sound on sound. You take the recorded voice, play that through the system with the new voices, so it would still be one track. You'd have double voices
track,
on one track.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would record Frankie's voice and then double Frankie's voice and do the same thing again.
All on four tracks.
Now, that's three tracks.
Three tracks.
If we were going to do any overdubs, we'd do the overdubs on
that. By the way, Charlie mentioned his book. It's called A Jersey Boy's Journey with the Four Seasons and Beyond. Another season, it's called The Memoirs of Charlie Colello. So where's that available? In
Barnes & Noble, Amazon.
Sure. Okay. Another season, The Memoirs of Charlie Colello. So let's move on a little bit because we know what the Four Seasons was all about during that period of time. But you had involvement with Neil Diamond as well. And as a matter of fact, with the song Sweet Caroline, I want you to tell us about that.
In 1969, it's been 50 years right now since we made that record. And when I got called to make it, I was called as an arranger. So I heard the song. I went home, wrote the arrangement, went to the studio, and recorded the horns and the strings. And when I walked into the studio and asked Neil how he liked it, he looked at me and says, well, I didn't hear anything wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked out of the studio very depressed.
Yeah.
I didn't think I did a good job.
Yeah.
And it eventually wound up being his biggest record.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, he wrote about, that it turned out to be so good, so good, so good.
Yeah, that whole.
But the interesting part about it is that when it comes time to singing the song, you can't sing the song without the bomp, bomp, bomp.
Yeah.
And it took me 4 seconds to write the bomp, bomp, bomp.
So you're the man behind the bomp.
I wrote the bomb, bomb, bomb.
Yeah, I think that's because that song has really spanned generations as well. I mean, I see it in movies now and the like. Everybody is something about that. That's actually pretty amazing. So just to kind of finish up this era of your work, you know, you toured with the Four Seasons, you were working with all these other artists, you were doing a lot of the arranging, you were getting the musicians in some of these cases, you know, kind of putting the date together. But all through that, the industry started to change with the invasion of the Brits. We had the Beatles, we had the Rolling Stones, and that must have shocked Tin Pan Alley, where all you guys were hanging out in New York, and, you know, the Brill Building and all of that. What was it like back then when the Beatles exploded on the scene?
The Four Seasons went to England in 1963. Frankie came back with a bunch of records. Five of those records were the first Beatle hits. And he went to Bob Crewe and says, we should cut these songs, we should cover these songs, and we should imitate these records. These are brilliant records. And Bob said, we write better songs. At that point, we had the opportunity to record all of those hits that were released a year earlier. Now, that's something that very few people know.
Yeah.
So the Beatles came in, the English Invasion came in, and it affected many of the groups. However, what was still strong on the airways was Motown. Mm-hmm. So what we did, we came from the Sherry Baby, Big Girls, Dawn Go Away. What we did was we leaned into the R&B field by doing Let's Hang On, Working My Way Back to You. And with the records after that, we sort of like caught a niche making Four Seasons kind of Motown records.
Well, it's interesting because really music came full circle there, because the Beatles were basing their music on Motown or that kind of music as well. That's where they started. Same thing with the Stones. So you were just, everybody's going back to the roots there.
Right. And then toward the end of the decade, it sort of fell apart a little bit, because then it started with the rock bands. And once it started with the rock bands and the concept records, I think the concept of putting whole stories together started to become part of the album work. And the Four Seasons were not an album-oriented group.
Yeah.
We were really a pop group.
Right.
And that transition sort of went by the wayside. And it took them a long time before they were able to get back on their feet.
Well, that was like Sgt. Pepper's was this concept idea that you listened to it, or the White Album. You listened to it from beginning to end. By the way, you used two cigar boxes around your ears when you were a kid. I used to take my dad's stereo speakers, put them together, and lay on the floor in the living room between them and hear the sounds go from one ear to another. Okay, so we had that in common. Oh, my gosh. So moving on, you then got an opportunity to work for Columbia, which was the big, you know, aircraft carrier. They had, you know, Miles Davis, Ella Fitzgerald, Duke Ellington, Barbara Streisand, Aretha Franklin. I mean, the list is so amazingly impressive. And you joined that organization, but you didn't really have the best of time there.
Well, when I joined them, I had Lightning Strikes as a hit record as a producer, The Name Game as a producer, plus I was making the Four Seasons records. So when they brought me in, they wanted me to start to make pop records for Columbia Records. The funny part about it was, although they wanted to move in that direction, the resistance corporately was something I was not used to. So I only lasted there a little less than 2 years. But I did make the album of my life, which was the Laura Nero Eli record.
Yeah, I didn't know you were involved with that until I read the book.
And after I made that record, I was fired for making the record.
Mm-hmm.
David Geffen made his career off of it.
Yeah.
Laura got a lifetime contract with Columbia, and I got fired.
Yeah, there's something just wrong with that, I can tell you. Unfortunately, we're low on time, so I want to move ahead. You say there are four stages to your career or to a person's career. I'm going to read them for you if you don't mind. Who is Charlie Colello? That's the first one. Who is this guy, right? Next one is, we got to get Charlie Colello. The third stage is, what we need is a young Charlie Colello. And now, whatever happened to Charlie Colello? So tell us, what are you doing now? What's happened to Charlie Colello?
Well, I found out that making hit records, I had a run of about 30 years. Then after 30 years, what happens is you don't speak the language anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You don't speak the pop language. But yet still, as an arranger, I didn't realize this when I was younger, that music is a lot more than just making hit records. So I continued to make records. I started to do what I really liked to do more, was to write for orchestra and to make records like that.
The work of a real arranger.
Exactly.
Not such as a pop hit maker, right? So that's the stuff you love.
Right. And making some of those records, I wound up doing an album like that with Ronnie Millsap. We went out and started conducting symphony dates. I came down here to Florida. I got involved with the Pops Orchestra.
Right. As a matter of fact, I was the president of the Symphonia here, which was a kind of part of that whole process.
And I started writing for the Pops Orchestras.
Mm-hmm.
and many of the pop orchestras. I wrote for Peter Nero.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to conduct. And a friend of mine talked me into doing a live concert. And I said, what would I do? He says, do your hit records.
Yeah.
I said, well, what would I do? He says, well, you had about 35 top 10 hits.
Mm-hmm.
He says,
I think you could fill a couple hours, right?
So I started to do the shows. And right now, between doing the shows and writing, I'm having a great time because it's so much fun to get up on a stage, perform the hits. And as you perform them, I realize that I'm living the best part of the music business without the drama.
Yeah, without the drama. Right, exactly. So finally, some quick advice for those young people who are trying to enter into this business, which has totally changed, to say the least. But still, talent should pave a way. What kind of advice would you have for a young person?
Well, making records is a business. And if you learn the business, you can really be successful at it. There is a simple formula, and it requires three things. You have to have a song, you have to have a song, and you have to have a song.
I think I'm getting your point there.
The other thing is that you have to become very conscious of what they're playing on radio and to be able to anticipate the curve, because by the time your record gets out, the curve is going to change.
Yeah.
So what you need to do, the best thing for young people to do is to try to write follow-ups to hit records that they hear on the radio now.
Mm.
If you're writing follow-ups, what happens, you'll get an idea to study song form. You'll understand what's on the record, what synthesizers, what beats, how it's structured, what kind of backgrounds. So it's really an education. If you have the education and you have the talent to be able to put it together, can you catch the brass ring?
Mm.
Well, every year there's a new artist,
yep.
There's a new producer, there's a new group of people that make records, and you could always have a chance.
Charlie Colello, the book is Another Season, The Memoirs of Charlie Colello, and you can see why I've asked him to come on the show and tell us some of his story. Charlie, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Don't forget to hear this interview again and any interview that we've had on this show or my commentaries, go to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com, and join our conversation. While you're there, sign up for our weekly update for all the upcoming live events that we have and the important topics that we've covered this week straight to your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com.